Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience around the world. We have a guest today from around the world. Are you there, James? Are you there, James?
Yeah. Can you hear me, Peter?
Yes, yes. Maybe a little delay.
Okay.
We'll be getting back to James in a minute. James Moore is going to be a very, very good guest. And tell you, and first apologize for not having done my frequent alerts for 2 weeks. A week ago, I spent a wonderful conference, co-sponsored it with Pam Popper, who has a group whose theme is informed medical decision-making, Pam Popper. She and I are working together on a number of projects. I gave 3 talks, and I invited Peter Gerze, who came and gave 2 talks. So you got 5 hours of some of the more interesting things that people talk about in psychiatry at this conference. I'll be doing it every year. I'm really working closely with Pam. So you could set aside to go to Columbus, Ohio. Not as bad a place to be as you might think. Lots of good restaurants. Lots of vegetarian restaurants. In Columbus, Ohio. Put it on your calendar for next year. It's going to be the weekend of November 8th, 9th, and 10th, and 11th, that weekend. Start thinking about coming to that conference. I met a lot of people there who came because of my radio show and my work. And most of them there because of Pam, who's been doing this conference for many, many years. So we are bringing together the concept of people having the right to informed decision making about what's best for their body, their brains, and their minds. It's the ultimate holism based on science, not on fad. Not on fad. And Pam is covering the whole field of medicine. I pitch in where I can, and I'm doing psychiatry, the whole field of psychiatry and psychology. Some of our future plans, well, we have a course going right now. It's the Shakeout Tour, so I haven't been advertising it a lot. And it's a course on why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. It's got 25 videos of me, a virtual archive that Pam created with me. Pam participates in it. We have a young psychiatrist who's just absolutely marvelous, who does the active work of doing the live part of it on the internet, whereas I just sat and over a period of days, you know, made one after another of 1 hour podcasts to integrate into the course. The course has college credit, officially approved by the Department of Education in Ohio. So this is one of the big projects. And when it starts again in a few months, I'll be sure to be making people aware of it. And people, you don't have to have credentials to take this course. And you can use it with your professional degree or however you find it useful. As a lay person, I've been busy with a lot of important legal work. I'm working on a couple of book proposals, so a lot going on. And of course, the great radio show, the great guests. So again, I apologize, and I'm hoping to have a really, really exciting frequent alert up in a day or two. It's I think my most impassioned blog may be going up in a day or two. So I'm busy, and don't be worried about my not doing a frequent alert. And remember, you go to the website, Bregan.com, and sign up for them. Sign up for the frequent alerts. The website is humming along with roughly around 2,000 visitors a day and around 10,000 visits, pages, which gets us into the millions a year. So we're doing good, folks, and we're working closely with MIA, which brings me to my guest. My guest is James Moore. He's been through the psychiatric system. He's experienced the psych drugs firsthand. He got convinced he was fundamentally broken. Imagine your healers. Our healers, our supposed psychiatric healers, begin by convincing us we're fundamentally broken. Shame. Shame on them. And James awakened eventually. He's going to tell you about it, to the realities of psychiatry. I have worked with James because he produces and hosts the first Mad in America podcast. And his podcasts have the really top people on them. A lot of them have been on my show. And I'm going to be looking at his show and having some of his people on, because he picks great people to have on his show. And he interviewed me twice. We did 2 hours, and I think it's one of the very best interviews of me that's been done, because I like James. He's a warm, caring person. He really understands what's going on. So it was a really, really good experience for me. So, folks, welcome from Great Britain, James Moore. Hi, James.
Hi there, Peter. Peter, thank you so much for having me on your show. It's such an honor for me, because you've been such a hero of mine for so many years. And, you know, I fondly recall, you know, the time we spent talking for the Mad in America podcast, and that was definitely a high point for me. So thank you so much.
Thank you, James, and thanks for doing such a good job letting me express my views to people. And you can find this, folks, you can go to it from my website, you can go to it from madinamerica.com. So, James, tell us, I think people, and certainly I'm very always interested in the stories behind what we do, so tell us about yourself and how you got into the situation you're in today, doing what you're doing, and also sounding so together and in touch.
Okay. Well, my story, you know, it's pretty ordinary, really. You know, I haven't had to endure, you know, forced treatment and some of those things that people do. But I've struggled for most of my life with anxiety. And in particular, my anxiety revolves around emetophobia, which is an intense fear of vomiting. It's not a very common phobia. So, for example, about 0.5% of the population in the UK have it. But, you know, like many anxiety problems, it can very quickly take over your life. So back in 2011, I was working actually for the UK Environment Agency at the time. I had a good job that I enjoyed. I'd just become a father to a daughter, and I was sociable, and I was outgoing. But I was aware of my anxiety, and of course it would plague me during meetings or presentations, but I was just about managing to keep it under control. But towards the end of that year, pressures began to build up for me. So I was struggling with stress at work, and I was also struggling, in all honesty, with the pressures of being a new father. You know, it was a real shock. And all of a sudden, I found myself at work experiencing daily panic attacks and not really knowing why. And of course, you know, I desperately tried to hide what I was experiencing from my work colleagues, because of course I thought, if they get a sense that I'm not really in control of myself, then, you know, I'm not going to be able to be relied upon. And, you know, that's a threat to my job. So I tried to hide it as best I could, but pretty soon even leaving the house started to become a huge and exhausting challenge. So, like many people in my position, you know, searching for answers, I went to my family doctor. And of course, you know, they got out the famous questionnaire and filled in a few tick boxes, and he diagnosed me with anxiety and depression. and signed me off with work and prescribed me an antidepressant, mirtazapine, which I think is called Remeron in the US.
Yes.
And, yeah, and I walked away with those tablets, you know, again, like many others, having been told that I had a chemical imbalance that this antidepressant would correct. And I was told that I'd probably need to rely on this medication for life. But my experience was that my medication increased my anxiety, although at the time, of course, I just thought it was a feature of my illness. And, you know, if I did report this back to my doctor either wanted to keep increasing the dosage or, of course, wanting to add another drug on top. And I had to turn down either an additional antidepressant or an adjunctive antipsychotic drug on at least 5 or 6 occasions. So having taken my antidepressant for a couple of years, I kind of came to the view that it was doing me more harm than good, and I wanted to stop. You know, I really wanted to believe in it, but I really had to admit that the adverse effects were really more troubling than I was getting benefit from it. So, of course, I went to my doctor and said, look, you know, I want to stop this antidepressant, been on it for a couple of years, how do I do that? And the advice of my local doctor at the time was, well, just take half a tablet for a week and then stop completely. And that's what I did, following my doctor's advice. But I found the experience of trying to stop my antidepressant to be deeply unpleasant and far worse, actually, than what I originally went to my doctor for. So I made repeated attempts to reduce, only to suffer each time with insomnia, nausea, increase in number and severity of panic attacks, restlessness, agitation. You know, Peter, you're familiar with all of this. You know, it's in your books. So after only a few days of reduction, I'd be bedridden, unable to eat, experiencing relentless anxiety and depression, and really unable to function at all. So, of course, you know, again, you go back to your doctor and you say, look, what is happening? My doctor's view that was that what I was experiencing was a return of my original symptoms, but I didn't agree because the effect was so sudden. And, of course, if I did go back to my previous dosage, I tended to stabilize quite quickly, so it was pretty obvious to me that this was a drug withdrawal effect, not a recurrence or a relapse of my previous difficulties. So eventually I managed to reduce to the lowest possible dose available in tablet form, but I wasn't able to get any further. So I asked my doctors for a liquid version of my medication, because liquid formulations are available for some, but not all antidepressants. And, of course, they allow you to taper your dose precisely, but it was too expensive for my health service to provide. So, you know, that wasn't a route for me. And also, while all this was going on, I made several attempts to get back to get back to my employment. But, unfortunately, none were successful. And eventually, I was made redundant on ill health grounds in 2013. So, you know, after being made redundant, Peter, I felt broken and I felt lost. I really felt like I would never work again. And that led to some really dark times and some intense suicidal thinking. And really, you know, in short, I feel actually that my antidepressant has kept me unwell rather than making any measurable positive impact on my life. And, you know, really, it was during this time that this was the kind of awakening I had. It was during this time that I came to realize that much of what we've come to believe about antidepressants is not true. And Peter, in a large part, you were responsible for much of my awakening to the realities of psychiatric drugs, because the first book I read on this subject was Your Drug May Be Your Problem, How and Why to Stop Taking Psychiatric Medications. And that book, Peter, along with my own experiences, kind of inspired me to reach out and connect with others who are experiencing similar things. And I wanted to do this partly because my own doctor, and, you know, I'd also seen a psychiatrist as part of this, they expressed complete surprise that there should be any issue at all and believed that once the drug was out of my system, in inverted commas, I should be completely fine. You know, and I felt, you know, being given that view, I felt the problem was just with me. I felt everybody else must be having a wonderful time on these drugs. I'm really suffering. I must be unusually sensitive, or I must be incredibly weak, or there must be some reason that this is happening to me. And, of course, that's when I found your books And I started to understand that this isn't actually a rare or uncommon thing at all. So, you know, that's kind of what led me to campaigning on this issue and trying to raise awareness of how many people struggle with these drugs when they try to come off. And, you know, it's following in your wonderful steps, Peter, because, you know, you've been telling us this in your books and all of your work for quite some time. And the way that I wanted to do that was, you know, as we do, you know, insomnia is quite a feature of coming off these drugs. So tossing and turning in bed one night, I thought, okay, I like to hear people talking about their own experiences of coming off the drugs. So I want to start a podcast, and I'm going to interview people about their experiences. So I started my own podcast. This was back in March this year, and it was called Let's Talk Withdrawal. And the aim really was to interview people like myself who had experienced withdrawal issues and to find out how they coped, what advice they'd give to others in a similar position, you know, how it affected their lives, what kind of medical advice they'd have, what their doctors had said to them. And part of it for me was the desire to reach out and connect, because the combination of adverse effects from my medication, the anxiety and the panic attacks, the loss of my job and my livelihood and my career, it all meant that I was pretty much unable to leave the house at all. I was housebound. So I felt almost totally cut off once I'd left work. And the podcast gave me back some of that connection. And running that podcast was an eye-opening experience for me, because I came to realize just how many people are struggling with exactly what I was, the physical and psychological toll that withdrawal takes on your health and well-being. And, you know, I was really fortunate to be able to hear the lived experiences of those who'd either come off the drugs or were in the process of. And I was also lucky to be able to interview some of the experts too. So I spoke to Professor John Reed, Dr. Joanna Moncrief, Professor Peter Gersher, and amongst others. And the reason that I did that was because I wanted to understand the real science of psychiatric drugs, not just what we're told in clinical trials or the flashy TV adverts, or even what my doctor's belief had been. And I wanted to understand how that science translated into the effect upon people's lives. And that was shocking and deeply troubling. People described to me how withdrawal had wrecked their lives, how unprepared they were by their doctors. And the worst of it, Peter, was how dismissive the doctors had been of their struggles. You know, in fact, many people seem to be put into this category of being labeled medically unexplained symptoms. So I'm not sure if it's the same in the US, but in the UK, that seems to be a bit of a catch-all for difficult patients that they don't know what to do with, so they mark you as medically unexplained. When, of course, we all know exactly what the cause of our problems was, and it had been prescribed to us. So having run my own podcast for a while, I came to interview Robert Whittaker. And as many of your listeners know, Robert Whittaker is an award-winning science journalist and science writer, and he founded the webzine Mad in America. And during my discussion with Robert Whittaker, it turned out that Mad in America were themselves keen to get into podcasting. And so now I'm very, very fortunate to be the host of Mad in America's first podcast. And again, you know, following in your footsteps, Peter, you know, where you've been before with your radio show for so long, the Mad in America podcast hosts the kind of critical discussions about science, psychiatry, and social justice that it's very hard to get from mainstream sources. And as you said, Peter, at the beginning, you know, it's how you and I first met when we, you know, had such a wonderful interview, you know, for the Mad in America podcast, and it was such an honor for me to speak to you. And I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to contribute in a small way to the aims and objectives of Mad in America, and also to be able to interview such luminaries as you, Peter.
Well, I had a good time being interviewed by you. you sound great on the radio, and you are great on the radio. You know, you're very present and you're very real, and you know, it's just nice to sit back as I am now listening to you talk. I had two questions.
We
don't have the concept here. I think we got your meaning, but we don't have the concept of being declared redundant.
Right.
What does in the U.S. what does that mean?
So that means effectively you are forced to give up your job effectively. But instead of sacking you, you know, instead of it being a misconduct or anything, they can make you redundant on ill health grounds. So you know, you have to give your job up, and you know, that's it. You don't work for that organization anymore. So it's a way to, you know, I'd been off sick, unfortunately, for quite some time. I'd made several attempts to get back into work, but of course, you know, each time the same thing happened and the same pressures came piling in, and very soon I collapsed under the weight of it again. So it was just a way for both me and my employer to reach a compromise on terminating my employment with them.
And my other question was, did you finally get off the drugs? You didn't carry us to that point.
Well, I'm still in the process of withdrawing now. So I'm not off them. I'm about halfway through my journey. But the approach I'm taking now is with the liquid formulation. So I'm happy to say that, I mean, it actually, ironically enough, it actually took us, you know, we you know, because I'd lost my job, you know, we were struggling with only one salary coming in. So we actually relocated, you know, to help us a bit with that. And I have to say, where we moved to in Wales, my local doctors now have been much more accepting of the fact that some people really do struggle with coming off these drugs. And, you know, by this time I've been on these drugs 5 years, so, you know, coming off is a big challenge. But it still took quite a lot of convincing to, you know, to get them to, firstly, to prescribe a liquid formulation. And liquid formulations are good because you can very gently approach your withdrawal. And if you're struggling at a certain point, you can pause. You can pause at 7.5 milligrams or 5.5 milligrams or whatever the place may be. You can pause there until your withdrawal symptoms have abated a bit, and then you can re-engage with your withdrawal thing. Because I learned quite quickly that to be too definite about having a target, you almost set yourself up for failure, because when you inevitably run into some of the difficulties, you need to then take a step back and say, am I trying to do this too quickly? So, you know, I am very fortunate because liquid formulations aren't available for all antidepressants. Some are only available in the UK and some are only available in the US. You know, and some poor people, as you know, Peter, are forced to cut pills or count beads or make up their own solutions. And I think that's a lot to ask somebody who probably already is in a very difficult place coming off the drugs. They're probably not sleeping. They're probably struggling with anxiety and depression. They're probably worried about... I agonize, Peter, over whether coming off the drugs is the right thing to do, because, you know, you kind of function to an extent on the drugs, and then you go through a period of not really functioning while you come off them. And of course, you don't know how long that process is going to take. And you don't know, actually, if at the very end of the process, you are going to kind of regain where you were before you took the drugs. That's the hope, of course. But people have very different experiences with these. And, you know, so I'm trying to be quite realistic about where my withdrawal journey takes me to. But, you know, the whole process has, you know, really led to me wanting to campaign on these issues. So, you know, alongside getting into the podcast thing, which was really, really beneficial for me because, as I say, it helped me connect with people and to reach out, and it helped me re-engage my creative side, which I'd kind of let go while I was on the drugs. I used to be a musician and I played in bands for many years, but all that was taken away from me, I feel, by my antidepressant. And so I started to campaign to raise awareness of the difficulties that so many people have.
Can James, may I jump in? Do you mind if I ask you a little more? I think people would be really eager to learn more about what your struggle is. Are you comfortable with that? Can I ask you more about it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Because, I mean, this is what people, above all things, there may be people who would just like us to do nothing but talk about this. And you have a lot of other things. If we don't get to them, then we'll just have you back sooner rather than later.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's wonderful for people to hear what you're going through. Now, so how much are you taking by dropper now?
So what I'm aiming for, Peter, is somewhere between 5% and 10% of my starting dosage per month. But as I say, I, you know, in a typical way that some people do these things, you know, I've made myself a nice spreadsheet and I put dates on it, but I rapidly threw that away because trying to be too specific about this means that not meeting your target makes you feel much worse about it. So what the initial stages of my withdrawal taught me was to ease up on myself. And if it takes a month to get between a 10% drop and a 20% drop, that's great. If it takes me 3 months to do that, that's equally fine. You know, I think I'm fortunate that I'm being allowed the time to take it at a pace that's right for me. And, you know, that's very important. And, you know, I have seen other people in forums and things really try and set themselves very hard targets for this. And I think that can be difficult. You know, some people manage it, of course, but I think it just adds a level of pressure, probably psychological pressure, to what's already physically quite a difficult process.
So in my practice, what I tell people is that you have to get used to a whole new way of thinking about your relationship with the doctor. You're going to actually be in charge of this. We're going to be paying attention to your needs. I'll be advising and guiding when necessary. But the real issue is the rate that you're going to be comfortable with. And people do vary a lot with that, very dramatically. And some people come off of the drugs rather rapidly, and some come off very slowly. And I have had one or two people who, at least while they were with me, didn't get fully off. But that's mostly that's a few years ago. So I'm very glad to hear what you're describing. I think that unless there's an emergency, somebody's developing tardive dyskinesia or some other emergency, I generally am going slower in my mind than my patient or client is, because I want them to be pushing themselves at their own rate rather than me pushing them. So I think it's great how you're going about it. Do you feel right now that you're better than before you started on the meds?
At the moment, in all honesty, no. My withdrawal thus far has been quite a struggle. But the good thing about that, Peter, is having read your books and having researched this a bit, I was prepared for it to be difficult. I think, again, it can be psychologically quite tough when my first, you know, as we said, my first withdrawal experience was with no knowledge at all, and I just tried to take half a tablet, and I all of the withdrawal effects hit me, and I was completely caught by surprise, and that, of course, made it much more difficult to deal with. So even though my withdrawal experience now is quite difficult, I'm prepared for it to be difficult, and I'm accepting that it's part of a healing process, and probably, in all honesty, a life change process to get from where I was on the drugs to being drug-free at some point in the future. I think it's too easy to see it as just not taking a pill anymore, but I think it's probably more fundamental than that. Certainly for me, can't speak for everybody. For me, as well as withdrawing from the drug, I have to make sure that I've made the necessary changes in my life that my anxiety when I was at work, my anxiety was there to tell me you are not living a fulfilling and sustainable life. You are in a job that, you know, causes you stress and anxiety and worry and all the rest of it. You've given up your creative pursuits. You know, you have withdrawn socially because things are tough. So I think for me, you know, part of it is the physical process of gradually reducing the amount of the psychoactive substance in my system. But similarly, you know, I while I've been on the drugs, I haven't been at all kind to myself. So, for example, one of the classic things that an emetophobe does is control their diet, you know, because emetophobia is all about a fear of losing control. You know, I'm kind of aware of that. And as an emetophobe, one of the first things you do is control what you eat. So my diet has been appalling. I've been living on toast and breakfast cereal for the better part of 2 years. And, of course, you know, that hasn't helped me prepare for withdrawal. So some of the reasons that I'm finding it tough are because I wasn't necessarily in the best place to start. But we're not always in the best place to start doing this thing. I think it can be helpful if people maybe think about, is this the right time for them? Because coming off a psychiatric drug, I think, is much bigger than just a physical process. And I think it is a process of learning to, you know, for example, learning to re-engage with your more emotional side. Because I'm a sensitive person, I wear my heart on my sleeve, but the antidepressant robbed me of a lot of my emotion. I became an automaton almost. You know, I lost contact with my feelings, and, you know, I lost contact with my ability to express my feelings. So, of course, when you start to withdraw your drugs, your feelings come back in a rush. So, you know, you're in floods of tears one minute, you're, you know, quite happy the next and thoroughly down the next minute. And learning to coexist again with that more emotional part of you, even that takes quite some time to sink in. And of course, you know, you know me being the kind of person I am, I want to understand all these effects. So I tend to think, is this a withdrawal effect? Is it the real me coming back? Is it a different me that I'm going to see more of as I go through? But I think, you know, I think those are the bits of withdrawal that certainly, you know, doctors don't understand that part of it. I don't think they understand the emotional and psychological journey that someone has to go on to get past these drugs.
Yeah, I think that many, many people, from my own experience, go on to have better lives than they had beforehand, even if they have residual symptoms that don't necessarily go away. Maybe they have some paresthesias or burning sensations that don't quite go away, or they have or get worse when they're anxious, or maybe they think that feel that their mental processes them aren't as machine-like quick as they used to be. I mean, they feel they're left with something. Not everybody, but say long-term people, they still can go ahead with a better spiritual approach to life, a more self-determined and loving approach to life. They have better lives than ever before. So I really want to emphasize that for folks out there. And also, don't let the difficulty James has had, although it's common, don't let it discourage you, because it's certainly better than staying on the drugs. And many, many people get off much more easily than that. So there's just such a broad and, to me, unpredictable or largely unpredictable range. But some people come off these two or three drugs in 4 or 5 months and they're feeling fine. And some children especially come off a couple of drugs, two or three drugs, fairly rapidly. They have a lot of support from their parents. And I emphasize, I haven't heard you say anything about this yet, James, but I really emphasize support group. Do you feel like you have a personal support group?
Yeah, Peter, I do. And, you know, that kind of personal support, you know, there's quite a lot of good groups on Facebook, for example. And, you know, my withdrawal experience, no matter how difficult it is, I wouldn't be here now talking to you on your show, Peter. You know, I wouldn't be having such conversations with people I admire so much. I wouldn't be working with Mad in America. I wouldn't be able to connect with people who I have so much respect for. So, you know, my withdrawal experience is part of a life change process. And, you know, you're absolutely right to say that it isn't difficult for many people. They can, you know, quite easily change drugs, swap drugs, whatever else. You know, I think it's important to understand there's a range of experiences, and also to understand that the best support that I've found is not medical in nature. It's people that have lived this and been there. It's people who have got through out the drugs the other side and can encourage other people. You know, it's people who have spent their time supporting others. You know, and I've spoken to many partners, and, you know, my own wife, you know, she she goes through the mill with me because she doesn't know from one day to the next how I'm going to be. And, you know, part of the challenge for me is how highly variable an experience withdrawal is. You know, one day I can be fine and fully functioning and doing all the things that I need to do and, you know, taking my daughter to school and all the things that I need to do. And the next day might be very different. So part of it is the variability of it. But I have to say that online support groups I've found hugely rewarding to be a part of. And I just see so much generosity of spirit of people that have really struggled with these drugs but are still willing to reach out and put their arms around somebody else. And I have to say that the online support groups, like, you know, there's a big website called survivingantidepressants.org, and I've been a member there for quite some time, and they offer volunteer peer support. And it means that if you're in crisis in the middle of the night, there's, you know, and if you're in the UK, there's probably somebody up in the States who's willing to talk to you on this group. And that's the kind of support that the medical community couldn't provide even if they wanted to. They can't provide that kind of nurturing, emotionally engaging, arm-around-the-shoulder support that people need. So I think, Peter, what really excites me about the experiences that I'm going through is that people like you, Peter, with all of your books and your work, you've allowed us, you've empowered us by giving us the facts and the science and the evidence that we need. And we can pool that knowledge with the real lived experience of people that have been there, been through it, know what it's like, and come out the other side. And I think the combination of the real science and the lived experience, you know, as I say, that's something that medicine on its own can't provide.
You know, you're saying this very well, and let me repeat the group you just talked about. It's survivingantidepressants.org.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm not familiar with them, folks, but they sound from James's description like they're a very worthwhile resource. I mean, it sounds good. I'm so glad that you have found that. What about the new training program at MIA? Have you been involved with that, the psychiatric drug withdrawal educational program there? I know I'm going to be filmed as a part of it in a month or two or something. So it's still in development. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I haven't been involved personally, but you're right, Peter. So MAD in America are starting something which, you know, I'm thrilled to say that you're part of, Peter, and, you know, it's so great that you're part of what MAD in America are doing. They are running a series of webinars on psychiatric drug withdrawal. And it's a series of seven webinars which they're really designed to explore the risks and rewards of withdrawing from a range of psychoactive prescription drugs. So not just antidepressants, but benzodiazepines, mood stabilizers, antipsychotics too. And also to look at the ways that people might achieve their withdrawal, because there are a number of ways to do it, of course. And really, as we've kind of mentioned, the course is kind of designed really to try and identify some of the shortcomings in not only our medical but also our community knowledge about withdrawing from psychiatric drugs. There is knowledge out there, but it's a great way to gather it together. And I think it's a really interesting approach to gather some of our leading thinkers, yourself, Peter, and others, and researchers in this field, alongside those that do have lived experience of withdrawing themselves or supporting others in their own withdrawal. Because what's interesting is so much of the knowledge and expertise in how to help people on the support side of things is held by people who, unfortunately now for good reason, are quite fearful of engaging with doctors and psychiatrists. So what we really want is for education to go both ways on these things. So for me to go into my doctor and say, look, here's some research. Here's why some people find this difficult. Here's how you can help people that come in after me and say they want to do the same thing. But there are people in my situation that, you know, they kind of won't engage with their doctors and psychiatrists now because they're quite fearful of it. So I think what's great about the Mad in America course is it can get all that knowledge and experience in one place. And I think it really demonstrates the power of the community to get behind these issues. And, you know, I have to say also that my feeling is the medical world seems, not in all aspects, but in some aspects, particularly in psychiatry, the medical world seems unwilling, for whatever reason, to allow those with lived experience to participate and to have a voice. And I think that's a real shame. I think psychiatry is missing something there. I think if it did allow patients more of a voice and really, really looked at the value of lived experience, I think it would be of benefit to us all. I think it would benefit psychiatry. I think it would benefit the people that are engaged with psychiatry. I think it would be quite a radical step forward for the whole of mental health care, really. But at the moment, I see quite entrenched camps of user community and then perhaps, you know, medical people on the other side. And, you know, Peter, you are one of the few who will step out from the mainstream and not say the party line and give us the facts and evidence and science that we need. And we would be lost without you and others like you writing your books and doing your work. But I think to combine that with the knowledge of the herd, if you like, the knowledge of the crowd, I think that's so important.
Well, thank you for all of your positive affirmation of my work. And I think there's so much of my work is out there now that there's just going to be other people carrying it on in one direction or another. So, I mean, that's a really good thing at this point. And the lived experience people, you know, you may be one of the biggest, if not the biggest voice in carrying out the work of people like myself and Peter Goetze and Bob Whitaker. And it's very good, very, very good you're doing what you're doing. When you were talking about psychiatry, listening to the voices of people who have been through psychiatry, who have actually experienced it, I'm pretty cynical and skeptical because, you know, psychiatry throughout history has been devoted to suppressing voices. So whether they're the voices of that the person is hearing that are there, as far as we can tell, out in the world, out in the ether, or whether it's the voices of people screaming in distress and loneliness in the state mental hospitals, or whether it's the voices saying, you know, we're having withdrawal reactions and being rejected, ridiculed, ignored, and given more medicines. So psychiatry's long history has been to suppress voices and then, in fact, to declare people improved when the voices stopped. So that if the person says, I don't want to take medicine, I don't want to take medicine, they're kept in the hospital and medicine's pushed on them. And finally, they have to say, they have to change their voice and say, I want medicine. And then they're okay. They're given their drugs and they're let out. But if they haven't been able to tongue them or spit them out or hide them, you know, they're suffering from the neurotoxin because all these drugs are neurotoxins. So I'm not very optimistic about my colleagues listening to voices when all they've been trained to do is suppress voices. Do you think I'm exaggerating?
No. I think it's probably me that's a raging idealist.
still hoping that human nature won't turn out to be what it is, to give folks power and pay them for it and give them authority with it and esteem and relationships with the national organizations and presidents of the countries and so on and so forth. And they hang on to it at all costs, right or wrong. And they do that.
Yeah, well, I do. I think, you know, I personally, you know, obviously, you know, Peter, I haven't been in this world for as long as you and as long as others in it. I personally feel that I am seeing more willingness of people like me to stand up and hold psychiatry at account and say, no.
Oh, absolutely. That's the hope.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I've done with you. I've done what you said. I'm going to now go off and do open dialogue or, peer support or you know, hearing voices groups or whatever else it might be. I think, you know, my perception was that psychiatry was held in very, very high regard but for many years. But, you know, I think the way they've approached the psychiatric drugs and, you know, some of the other things they do, I really think people are waking up, again, with your guidance, to really the fact that, you know, they a lot of the treatments that they claim are based on science and evidence, actually, when you look into it and when you take the time to understand the science and evidence behind it, it really doesn't stack up. There really isn't the justification there for compulsorily drugging people or, you know, for having these antipsychotic pills that report back whether the person taking it has taken it or not. You know, these are things that, you know, people need to challenge and need to walk away from. And you know, I think there's a very important role for people to have that awareness and to raise that awareness in others.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly important role. I think it's going to be heard by the society and the culture and the people who have been injured and the people who want to help with psychotherapy. I can't imagine too big a place for it in psychiatry because it would have to change so much of its fundamental orientation. We'll see. It'll just be interesting for you to watch this unfold. But you are already having a voice, and it's reaching me, and it's now reaching my listeners, and you know, you're doing a great job with that, and that's what we need more and more of. We need more and more James Moore out there. We need people just starting with a podcast and then finding some place to really amplify it and get all this information out. The establishment doesn't want this information out. The pharmaceutical industry is one of the most powerful lobbying and influencing networks in the world, and they fight this every step of the way. So good work. Now you mentioned when we were talking earlier before the show, the Dr. Van Os, I think his name is, and some innovation he was developing. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, again, this is another example of where people have, I guess, got a bit fed up of waiting for medicine to make its mind up on whether it's going to help people or not. So some of your listeners might know of Professor Jim Van Os, who's a psychiatrist in the Netherlands. And he works with a group of people who are doing some really interesting work, and they are based at the User Research Center of Maastricht University in the Netherlands. And the contact that I have is a guy called Dr. Peter Groot. And Dr. Groot is a scientist who himself experienced depression and had been medicated with an antidepressant. And he also found that even if he missed a single tablet, he didn't feel very well at all. And of course, when he tried to stop his drugs, realized that what he was experiencing were withdrawal symptoms. So what he did was really interesting. He worked with an independent, not-for-profit pharmaceutical laboratory called Cinderella Therapeutics, and they created something called tapering strips. And like many great ideas, tapering strips are elegantly simple, really. What they do is they utilize pills of very small dosages in combination and then package them individually so someone can gradually and steadily reduce their psychotropic medication dosage. So it's rather like using coins in your pocket to make up any denomination of money. You can combine small dosage pills to make up every dosage from where a person was, let's say for argument's sake, 20 milligrams, and then over a period of time, they can reduce you very slowly to zero. And all you have to do is open each successive pouch each day, and it has the next day's reduction already taken into account. And so Dr. Groot and his colleagues, as I say, this is completely independent of the pharmaceuticals, which is the nice thing about it, because the pharmaceuticals should be doing this, but this doesn't fit in with their business model. Their business model is getting and keeping people taking these drugs. So Dr. Groot and his colleagues have made tapering strips available for 24 different psychiatric medications. So they cover many kinds of antidepressant, quite a lot of the antipsychotics, the anxiolytics, and the mood stabilizers too. And using this, they've been able to help well over 2,000 people, mainly in the Netherlands, but some in the UK and some in the US too. They've helped over 2,000 people to either stop their psychiatric drug completely or to reduce to a level that they feel is suitable for them. And one of the interesting things was Dr. Peter Groot actually undertook a blind trial on this himself as part of the development work. So he blinded himself, and then he withdrew from his drugs using tapering strips, but he didn't know when it was going to occur. And then he recorded his mood and his symptoms as he was going along. And I just think it's another example where instead of waiting for doctors to catch up with this, instead of waiting for the torturous process that medicine often goes through to make any kind of decision about helping people, they've gone ahead and they've been empowered enough to do something which, you know, now, you know, the public availability of this is probably some time off. People can get them, and if it's okay, I'll give a website address in a minute if people are interested in it. But I think it just shows that a few committed individuals who get together can actually achieve so much more than, you know, if we'd spent all this time trying to lobby doctors and trying to lobby pharmaceuticals, because at the end of the day, Peter, we know their hearts aren't in it. They have no interest in getting people off these drugs. So tapering strips are a brilliantly simple concept, and particularly for people who, you know, for imagine, let's say, you know, one of your elderly parents wanted to come off their psychiatric drug and you wanted to help them. Now, they might not be in a position to pill cut or measure syringes to the 0.1 milliliter or to count beads or to make up solutions. That might be very difficult for them. Tapering strips, as they are, all they'd have to do is take the next strip, the next, you know, bunch of pills each day, and they would reduce gradually over time. So, you know, it's pretty foolproof. It's, of course, not a solution for everyone, because some people are going to need to take more time over it. Some people are going to have to vary how they approach. But I think it's just a really good example of a user community getting together and doing something really positive to help people.
Now, these are not yet for sale to the public?
The public can, certainly the public in Europe and the UK can buy them. Now, they're sold at cost basis, so they're not making any profit on these. And they've been investigated by the UK Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Agency, and they've said they fully comply with all the legislation. Now, obviously, I'm not sure of the how things work in the US. I'm not sure whether the FDA has had a chance to review their work. But people can go onto the website and they can read about the project and they can see how tapering strips work. So if it's all right to give
yeah,
the website
sure.
address.
Yeah, sure. Folks, this is something I know nothing about at all. but there's absolutely nothing wrong with your putting it up on the, from what you've told me, telling people about it.
Great. Well, the website is www.taperingstrip.org. And tapering strip is all one word. So www.taperingstrip.org. And if you go to that website, you can read all about the project. You can see how the pills work. And I think it's a really fascinating development and really interesting, because it's gone on completely independent of the pharmaceutical manufacturers, who, as we say, would never come up with a solution like this because it doesn't fit their business model.
And it really doesn't, folks. We've talked a little bit about this on the radio show. The business model for the pharmaceutical industry is not to cure, but to treat chronic illness forever. And in many cases, I do believe they know that they're creating illnesses that will keep patients taking them forever. I don't know how the psychiatric pharmaceutical industry could not know that they are creating chronic biochemical dysfunctions in the brains of patients, just like in animals, and that people get confused and take psychiatric drugs to try to deal with the adverse effects when the treating them as if they're actually the fault of the patient. And this is the model, is the efficient making money model, and these large organizations, they do not, in my experience, and I have quite a bit of experience with these drug companies, they generally are not operating on anything remotely like an ethical level. And in fact, they're perfectly willing to continue to admit that to the Department of Justice, based on the kind of critiques that I've been making for decades. That now the Department of Justice makes them, and they collect a billion or so, or 2 billion, or 3 billion from the drug company, or sometimes less. And they're doing it with numerous drug companies, indicating a pattern. Unfortunately, the money doesn't go back to the folks; it goes into the government coffers. And it's one more never-ending circle of corruption. But that's what we're living with, and I think it's wonderful to have small companies break out of the model, operating on ethical means, we hope, and legally, and break out of the model and start coming up with some solutions. It's not going to come out of the pharmaceutical industry.
No, you're right. And you know, you quite often, Peter, you know, and I'm sure you'll have seen this, you run into things that make you think, actually, is the whole pharmaceutical model of mental health care just designed to get as many people on the drugs for the longest possible time? And I'll give you a little example. Peter, you know an awful lot about the package inserts or the leaflets that come with the drugs, because you've been highly influential in getting warnings into the labeling in the U.S., certainly. And I was just looking at the leaflet that came with my mirtazapine the other day, and in the U.K. version, it states, continue taking your medication for 6 months after your depressive symptoms have resolved. Now, that advice on its own, I mean, firstly, there's no study reference, there's no evidence or scientific paper you can go to find where they did the study that said 6 months is the right number. It just seems to be plucked from thin air. But that advice on its own can easily lead people to taking the drugs far longer than necessary, but often not realizing that there are adaptations being made in the brain that could make future withdrawal quite difficult. So, you know, you really start to get a sense that actually this is quite a cleverly organized campaign to keep people on the drugs. And, you know, similar messages like the chemical imbalances and, oh, like this is insulin, this is like insulin for a diabetic, and, oh, there's no problem relying on these drugs for life, that's fine. So, you know, I think what's nice about seeing, as you say, Peter, these little cottage industries coming up and saying, well, we've got a way for people to do this themselves, I think the maximum opportunity we can give for people to get their lives back and have some informed consent about the drugs that they take, I think we should welcome that with open arms.
Hi, I'm here. That what you're doing, the groups you're working with, will really encourage people not just to resist psychiatry, but to and to talk about the negative effects, but to reach lovingly toward each other, to encourage people to believe that even if your brain has residual injuries, your spirit can grow bigger and bigger and bigger, and you can have a better and better life. Do you hear much of that coming from anyone in the people who are dealing with the recovery?
Yeah, I do, very much so. I think there's a real positive spirit out there of people discovering these things for themselves and making real progress in their lives.
We're done. The music is playing. James Moore, wonderful to have you on. So glad that you're on MIA. Folks, listen to his podcast, and bye-bye now.
Peter, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure, and happy Thanksgiving to all of your U.S.
listeners. Oh, gosh, yes. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving.